Hello and welcome to the Transatlanticist Politics Podcast at the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg. I'm your host, Andrew Solon. Today we'll be discussing the European parliamentary elections, which were held on June 6th through June 9th. But before we do that, I have two announcements to make. First of all, the Amerikazentrum and I have been producing the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast this year in order to celebrate the 30-year anniversary of the Chicago Hamburg sister city relationship. So check out the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast if you want to learn more about the history and culture of Chicago, as well as the German influence on Chicago's development. Second, as we complete that project, we will go back to publishing more episodes about politics and transatlantic relations on the Transatlanticist. It is an important election year, both in the U.S. and Europe, so you can look forward to some more episodes analyzing the upcoming elections. And now on to the European parliamentary elections with Dr. Günter Donner, our resident expert on all things related to the EU. Welcome, Günter.
Thanks for having me.
Good to see you again, and good to hear you again, and good to have you back talking about our favorite subject, the European Union. So there are 27 countries in the EU, and there are over 370 million eligible voters. So this is a pretty big deal, getting 27 countries to coordinate the process. And by all accounts, it was smooth throughout Europe with no major issues, some small issues potentially in Romania. But by and large, this was a smooth election process. The voters are selecting 720 representatives for the European Parliament, which is divided proportionally. So bigger countries get more representatives. Germany gets 96 seats, that's the most. France gets 81, and poor little Malta and Cyprus only get 6 each, Luxembourg as well. Members of the EU Parliament earn a salary of about 120,000 euros a year, plus 5,000 euros a month for general expenses. And perhaps another interesting point is that the EU Parliament actually moves back and forth between Brussels in Belgium and Strasbourg in France, which seems like a huge waste of time and money, but hey, it's hard to govern 27 countries without some bureaucratic bloat. So, Günter, let's just start by reminding our audience about the powers that the EU Parliament has, and then maybe you can talk about how it interacts with the other main EU institutions, namely the European Commission and the European Council.
Well, the Parliament is one of the so-called seven EU institutions. There are, among others, the European Commission you've just mentioned. There is the Court of Justice. There is the Council of Europe, which is the assembly of state ministers, normally on certain issues they are responsible for at home. And there is the European Council, which is the assembly of the heads of state. And then there are two others. So this is the European Court of Auditors, and there is the European Central Bank. As a parliamentary institution voted for by the broader public, it's rather new. In the end of the 70s, the first such election was held. And at that time, the power of the parliament was very limited, practically nothing. Because it stands to reason, power, you cannot multiply it out of nothing. It's either settled at the local, within the local state, or it's transferred. And this transfer has gradually, over the last decades, really amassed a quite substantial amount of influence and power for the European Parliament, clearly with the idea of reinforcing, underlining, and making credible the democratic structure of the EU as an institution or a number of institutions working together. They still have limited possibilities, which is probably the one to pick here, is they cannot make suggestions. So they can not come up with and say, this guy or this lady now has to be president of the EU Commission. What they can do is the member states agree upon a person and they can say yay or nay to it. They can also dissolve the entire commission, not just one person, the entire commission in a type of vote of no confidence. It's never happened. We were once close to it many, many decades ago, but it never materialized. So the power is enormous. It's the normal parliamentary powers, budget questions, questions of how to develop politics. And that is very important. They can give working orders to the commission. You develop a plan to whatever, reduce CO2 emissions within the next year or next 10 years or whatever. You develop a plan to do this and to leave that. And the commission then has to present solutions set up by their experts, and the parliament and the member states have to negotiate on that. So this is a pretty close to what a normal parliament would do. It is a normal parliament now, with a few exceptions, just as I mentioned.
Yeah, so just to highlight some of those. So first, the overall, let's say, political goal of the parliament is to lend more of a democratic feeling to what to many European citizens feels like an aloof, far away bureaucratic structure that is the EU, which many one-time EU country, Great Britain, detractors of the EU would always talk about these decisions being made by bureaucrats in Brussels. And the EU Parliament sort of politically is meant to soften some of those objections. And I just want to highlight one more point, which is that the Parliament, although it can suggest things to do, it cannot bring its own legislation.
No.
The legislation itself is brought by the Commission, and then it is voted on by the Parliament.
And by the member states, yes.
And then maybe I'll just add the third point, much like the U.S. Senate, while the executive branch in the U.S. can appoint, say, Supreme Court judges or ambassadors, the U.S. Senate has to confirm them. And in that respect, the EU Parliament confirms choices made by the other branches.
The idea of Parliament is important. And we can see, and this is links up to the recent election, that slowly but surely the idea of parliamentarism in Europe and the idea of Europe as an entity and not a vague combination of national interests on the basis of highly sophisticated legal treaties. And please, it's very easy to throw overboard bureaucracy. Criticizing bureaucracy is is a hobby horse of many.
A favorite pastime of all citizens everywhere.
Yes, but the thing is, at the same time, expecting proper administration to function and criticizing bureaucracy for its sheer existence is contradictory. You can't have one without the other. Bureaucracy, of course, may fizzle out into almost ridiculous symptoms of cul-de-sacs and bogged down minds and ideologies from the scrapyard. We have many examples for that in Brussels, but we have the same amount of examples at national level. So the idea of a functioning democracy, which in the end has to form legal basis, has to form political strategies, has to form economic evaluations, and probably military or political evaluations for the future scenarios, you need experts to do it. And these experts are called bureaucrats. I once was one of them.
We forgive you. Okay, let's go into the inner workings now, more of the European Parliament, by looking at the way it forms groupings or blocks. So we said there are 720 seats in Parliament. Mm-hmm. So, you know, how do these groups form? Well, they form into blocks. We might call them parties, but they're supranational parties. Mm-hmm. And I'll just outline the biggest ones. We have the European People's Party, which is a center-right bloc. So, for example, the German center-right party, the CDU-CSU, is part of the European People's Party. We have the Group of Socialists and Democrats. So these are social democrats. And again, Germany's SPD party, Olaf Scholz, the Chancellor of Germany, his party, is a member of this grouping. Then we have the Renew Europe group. And we're going to come back to this because this is essentially a centrist party led by Emmanuel Macron of France, who, well, we'll get into Macron later. This was a challenge for him. Then we have the European Conservatives and Reformist groups. And this is a little bit more right-wing than the European People's Party. Even farther right of that than is the Identity and Democracy group. This is hardcore right-wing nationalist groups. Then we have the Green group and the Left group. Mm-hmm. So do you want to make any points about any of those groups before we look at how they did their results in this election?
Yes. What is probably interesting, and if you look back upon the whole process of all these groups coming into existence, people had their own political and parliamentary traditions. So we in Germany had different traditions from we in England. The French had their own party system. And so now, out of a sudden, these parties had parts of their activity in Brussels and Strasbourg. But there, of course, the idea of a European bunching up of these similar political stances proved to be very efficient. And the People's Party is a very good example. I mean, there are huge differences if you look at the CDU or the Gaullists or whatever, who is now part of it. It changed every now and then, of course. But these people have to form their own groupings, parliamentary groupings. They have their own agendas. They have their own internal difficulties. They have to pre-negotiate suggestions because a member of Group A in France may think differently about an issue than a member of Group A in Italy. But this is very European. What we still lack, and this is what I would like to add here, is a pan-European party movement. And I think we will be continuing lacking that for a number of decades.
What do you mean by a pan-European party movement?
That I could vote for a party that is partly manned by French, Spanish, Portuguese, and German, and whoever. So a European party. That would, of course, then have to be part of the German parliament as well. And that's exactly where it doesn't work. We have European party constructions, and that is these groupings, but they're not parties in their own right. So people can vote every 5 years at the European election for them. But one could have a liberal party of Europe. But this wouldn't be very successful at the national level because they are too remote.
Okay, yeah. And then maybe just one little point before we move on is occasionally what we see is when national parties who are part of these various groupings in the EU Parliament, when they do bad things in their own countries, sometimes they are thrown out of their European parliamentary group, which we saw, I believe, with the Alternative for Germany, the AfD, this year. They were deemed even too extreme for their European parliamentary grouping. This was the European Conservatives and Reformist group, which is kind of led by the Prime Minister of Italy, Giorgia Meloni. Anyway, let's look at the results. And here what I'm going to do just is go through the results. But what we're going to do is just show how they did compared to last time. So let's just start with the biggest group, which is, as we said, the European People's Party. So of the 720 seats, it has a little bit over 25%. So it got 186 seats. And most importantly, it increased its number of seats from 5 years ago by 10. So plus 10. And that's clearly the biggest group. And so they will be able to set much of the agenda and people will want to join with them, other groups, to get a parliamentary majority. And again, we'll talk about this in just a minute or two. This means that Ursula von der Leyen, the current head of the European Commission, has a pretty good chance of getting a second term leading the executive branch of the European Union, which is the Commission. Okay, in second place, we get the Socialists and Democrats grouping. But they've lost 4 seats from last time. Yep. They have a total of 135 seats, so just under 20%. So those are the two main groups, the European People's Party and then the Socialists and Democrats. And just in simple terms, this is the center-left party and the center-right party together have about 45% of the vote. Mm-hmm. And now we start splintering quite quickly. The Renew Party is the big loser. This is the Macron-led centrist group. They lost 23 seats, which is enormous. They only got 79 seats, minus 23 seats. So they're only 11% of the European Parliament now. The Conservatives and Reformers gained 4 seats. They're up to 73, so 10% of the European Parliament. Identity and Democracy, the far-right grouping, did quite well as well. They increased their seats by 9 plus 9. For a total of 58 seats, which is about 8% of the parliament. The Greens did the worst. The Greens lost 18 seats, which is a huge drubbing for Europeans. Green parties down to a mere 53 seats, so just under 7.5%. And then the left pretty much stayed the same. They're stuck at 36 seats, which is 5% of the European parliament. And then there are a number of non-aligned seats that have gone, and presumably there are 100 non-aligned seats. So of the 720 seats, 620 belong to these groupings that we talked about. 100 are non-aligned, and this is 38, but some of them will probably form or join some of these groupings. That just hasn't happened yet. We're recording this on Tuesday morning, and the elections just ended Sunday. So Gunter, let's just now look at, I think, the biggest talking point, which is what happened to Emmanuel Macron, who was perceived to be the biggest loser here. So what happened in France was that his party received far fewer votes than last time for the European Parliament, and the far-right party, led by Marine Le Pen, received far more votes, so received first place. So why don't you just analyze that a little bit more and tell us what's going on in France?
What's going on in France is a big public discontent with the Macron government. It's based on interior politics, mostly on social politics. One has to add, however, that in the 2019 European election, the Macron movement had just come out practically a fledgling, a newcomer, and took lots of seats in the European election away from other parties because it had never been part of the European Parliament before.
Again, this is a Renew, what's called the Renew group, which lost 23 seats, most of them French.
The Renew thing is a new name added to the Liberal Alliance that was called before. When Macron entered the political scene with his new party, La France En Marche, he added his weight to the liberal grouping by joining them. So they were pretty strong to start with from the last election. Now they lost because he's lost lots of confidence in France, and he was punished for that. The dramatic things is he has no other opponent than Madame Le Pen and her right-wing party. Neither the socialists nor the Gaullists are strong parties anymore in France, and they have never managed to recover from their catastrophic losses during the last French presidential election and the last two probably. So the thing is, the alternative Macron versus Le Pen is now running down through the whole scale of political influence, and I would say from the presidential office as the highest to the member in the Assemblée Nationale, which is the parliament, to the rather influential small regional political circles. Everywhere, Macron's party as such has been losing dramatically. And the sole winner, the sole alternative in inverted commas presenting itself is the rather well-organized movement of Madame Le Pen. There is one other, an extreme, ultra-extreme left-wing alliance. The left in France, always very strong, the extreme left, and as radical as Madame Le Pen in many aspects, they stagnate. And protest is just channeled through to Madame Le Pen. And this is the evening before the now fundamental, the bombshell decision of Macron to dissolve Parliament and to vote on June 30th and 7 days later again.
Yeah, so this, the big news is after Macron saw how poorly his party did and how well the far-right party in France did, he basically is calling what might be a bluff of the French people, or not, we'll see, but he called elections for just the end of this month, just a mere 3 weeks away, for Parliament in France. And basically what he's doing is telling the French people, okay, well, you voted the far-right party into the EU Parliament. Was that just a protest vote, or are you really going to now want Marine Le Pen to run the country even more? And this goes back to some of this, and maybe we'll just take a step back here, some of the role that the EU Parliament elections has generally in democracy in Europe. The EU parliamentary elections, many see as simply wild protest voting.
Yes.
So if they're, say, dissatisfied with what's going on in Germany, they might not actually vote for the far right in Germany, but they feel like, well, the EU parliament isn't that important. I'm going to at least vote for the far right for Europe. And this is the logic that operates with the European parliamentary elections. I know you don't like necessarily political forecasting. Do you think Macron did the right thing to call snap elections?
It's been a dramatic decision. But let's face three issues here. A, he has no solid majority in the Assemblée Nationale, the parliament, anymore. His long overdue pension reform he managed more or less by a presidential decree and going to the extremes of the French constitution, allowing him to do a lot more than your president could do on his own. The third aspect sometimes overlooked is in 27, he cannot run again. He cannot run again for president because you're not allowed to do it more than two times following one another. So he would have to drop out for one period or whatever, and then he could come back. So the thing is completely open what will happen after Macron. And there is no candidate I could now put a name to. I think our listeners should have an idea. There's two big explanations for how this will unfold. The one is Macron. So the more you are to the left, the more you say Macron has lost reason. He's a madman. He now is on the way of dramatically ending his own career. So the only thing that could save France from where she stands now is more communism, more radicalism, more whatever, and less Europe and less capitalism and whatever. That is the ultra-left stance shared by a few media people. Even here in Germany, I've read nonsense like this. The other is Macron wants to sharpen the conflict. And he wants to leave Marine Le Pen even in a cohabitation, which is the French word for a president from one camp and a prime minister from another. And then let her show, can she govern? And she can't. Or can she just criticize and egg on people, fight this, fight them, do this, do that, or blame or deliver culprits to the gallows? Can the ultra-right in France govern? Are they able to? It's, of course, a very risky game, let's face it. It could backfire, but he has the right to dissolve Parliament again, if he so wishes.
Yeah, I agree, very risky. But setting up the protest party in government has its dangers. But also, as you noted, it allows people to actually make a judgment.
Yeah.
Can a protest party actually govern? And that's a good way of now transitioning to Germany and the AfD, the Alternative for Germany, Alternative for Deutschland, received the second most share of the votes in Germany. And we'll see what happens to them. It's not that they will be in a position of government right now. But again, as a protest party, the question always is, okay, well, if they ever do gain power, can they actually do anything about it? But I just want to pause on other issues related to Germany and the EU parliamentary elections now by looking at historical turnout.
Yeah.
And I just want everyone to note, and this is quite interesting, as I said, the EU parliamentary elections aren't deemed to be so important. And Europe-wide, participation in the EU parliamentary elections is fairly low. So mm-hmm. around 50% historically mm-hmm. going back to 1999, you know, 49%, 45%, 43%, 42%, 50%. The numbers aren't out this year. I think they're a bit higher Europe-wide. Mm-hmm. But let's just look at Germany, because I think it's really interesting that in 1999, turnout was a mere 45%. In 2004, 45%. In 2009, 43%. 2014, 48%. And then in 2019 and this year, 2024, we see a huge increase in voter Indeed. Participation, massive for the European parliamentary elections. So in 2014, it was 48% turnout. 2019, it jumps to over 61%. And mm-hmm. this year, it's nearly 65%. So in a mere 10 years, we've gone from 48% to 65% voter participation. And I looked at that statistic, and the first thing I thought was, Gunther, how do you explain this massive increase in voter participation?
Well, there are a few, I think, quite credible explanations for that. The one is in a few countries, in a few only, but among them Germany, the voting age was lowered, and now you could vote at the age of 16. Remains to be seen exactly how many young voters turned out and how many of them voted for extreme parties. But the idea of Europe, if you look at 2019, we had the dominant issue is climate change, the climate subject, climate crisis, how to save the world, that mobilized many people to understand this is probably a European issue, because if a small state as Belgium or Germany decide we leave this and we do that, and the others won't follow, the whole thing remains of relative value. That is one thing. This is this subject somehow was losing in momentum. So now others are fight against inflation, preservation of a welfare state, individual socioeconomic chances and possibilities. The war issue in Ukraine, it's high on the agenda, be this for peace now and talk about it later, or how does Europe react? Another is, can we rely on America with a Trump presidency, a new one?
You really think issues of Ukraine and are increasing turnout that much?
Yeah.
Okay. I that's not the answer that I was expecting. I didn't have another answer, but that certainly doesn't explain the huge jump from 2014 to 2019, though. Although I take the
well,
point
that was economic, ecological issues in those times. Between 2014 and 2019, the ecological thing was orchestrated and became a much talk thing. I remember all these green deals and all this thing that was discussed, and legislation was passed doing this or leaving that. So actionism and action was demanded, because the whole thing had the idea this is the problem to tackle now. Now we know that there are others.
Right. Well, but then, interestingly enough, then, if that indeed were the case in 2019, and I do note that the Green Movement kind of was reaching its peak around then.
Indeed.
But what we noticed this year, while voter turnout remained high mm-hmm. at 65% for Germany, Europe-wide, the Greens really took the biggest drubbing. So
they did.
Maybe Greens are still voting, but not necessarily voting for green parties anymore. That's an interesting point. Let's stick with Germany now. So the so-called traffic light or Ampel coalition in Germany, which is led by the SPD, Olaf Scholz is the chancellor. That's his party. I think it's fair to say that the SPD did extremely poorly in the European parliamentary elections, finishing beneath the CDU, the center right, and the AfD. And people were wondering and asking the question of Olaf Scholz, oh, are you going to follow Macron's lead and dissolve parliament and order new elections, which of course he's not going to do. But how bad are things for the SPD?
Very, very much so. The SPD and Scholz are probably, if you compare a political coalition to a human part of part of a human lifespan, they're on their deathbed, but they are not allowed to meet their maker. There is no common denominator worthwhile naming among them. The only thing is they have to carry on until September 25, when the radical election comes, because the Macron issue cannot be copied in Germany. Dissolving his coalition means Scholz leaves his office. Macron remains president of France with Le Pen as probably minority prime minister, and he can easily dissolve the whole lot if he doesn't like it anymore. He can have her as a puppet, destroy herself by idiotic political suggestions, and showing the public that's what comes of it. Scholz has to go with his party. So there is just the way that another chancellor is elected, but this won't happen. Nobody steps into his footprints now. So I think he will continue like he always does.
His spokesman said as much.
Yeah, he won't move the upper lip. And the thing is now, the opposition in Germany, the CDU, they're quite happy about what they made in Europe with the European People's Party. But let's not forget, much of the discontent with the traffic light, or as we say, ample government, doesn't materialize in huge wins for the CDU. They are stable around 30%, maybe 31, maybe 32. Okay. But this means in the end, even after September 25, they need a coalition partner. The idea if we make it on our own is finished, as is finished the traditional alliance with the liberal. The liberal, we have to explain here for American listeners, is not what you call a liberal. A liberal in Europe is a socio-economic liberal. So it's a lower tax burden, a work should pay for itself, and all this type of movement. It's not what you consider a liberal. So the liberal party in Germany is probably finished. So the coalition partners for these, whoever becomes the CDU chancellor hopeful, probably Herr Merz, the choice of coalition partners is probably limited to either the SPD or what's left of that, or the Greens, what will be very difficult, because the Greens, and we have to stress this, have enormously lost, not more than lost in votes, they have become a public enemy for many voters due to idiotic politics. Not just that what they suggest is always wrong, but the way they propose their suggestions and the bureaucratic fine-tuning of their suggestions has led to their disastrous political stance. So the coalition will continue until its bitter end. Scholz will stay in office, calm as usual, and knowing that his party might be needed after the next election. That is there is no way out from that. The CDU won't win an absolute majority, no way.
Right. So let's just talk about now back to Europe. Let's go back to Europe. But I want to end in Germany, but let's go back to Europe. Based on what we saw in the European parliamentary elections, now, are we going to see any drastic changes in what's coming out of Brussels or Strasbourg? It looks like von der Leyen, as I said, will get a second tenure as president of the European Commission. And von der Leyen, of course, is from the European People's Party and German. So we're expecting more of von der Leyen for the next period. Any other implications for what's happening in Brussels, or are things pretty much staying the same?
Well, von der Leyen, let me stress this, I think she's a very shrewd politician. She's free from ideology. She's extremely experienced. She's very well spoken in at least three languages, which is a huge advantage if you wish to gain confidence upon others. And she's very clever in terms of forming alliances. She needs one alliance to be confirmed as president of the European Commission. Then later on, she needs majorities for content, for suggestions, for legislation proposals. She needs suggestions. But those alliances can be composed out of different elements, and she knows it very well. Her Green Deal from 2019-2020 is probably has already moved behind the scenes has been slightly remodeled. The re-evaluation of nuclear energy is a major step towards more reason and towards more, we need something to do, but it has to work together with other fields of activity, such as economic growth. One other thing I would like to stress is the Meloni government of Italy. The Meloni government is the sole Italian government I remember during my lifespan, which is now pretty old, that it has won and decisively won in the European elections while staying in power in Italy.
That's a really good point, yeah.
This has never happened before. And Mrs. Meloni had been... the party has origins we don't have to talk about anymore. Inconceivable in other countries. But monuments in Italy are one thing. We have monuments of terrible Roman emperors crucifying thousands. We still adore them. We have art, works of art made for Renaissance popes who were really real devils in power. But Mrs. Meloni was demonized as an anti-European. She would destroy Europe. Nothing of that happened. She supported Europe. She helped, at least she did something to reduce bureaucracy where its growth, hindering growth, especially by small companies in Italy. She has supported the Ukraine issue for Europe. She has been to Kiev. Her party has never taken money from Putin. And she just sidelined figures like Salvini, who once was taking Putin's money, and a huge figure in the Italian right-wing scene. Berlusconi is no longer among us, and his successor, Tajani, is a harmless person. He once was a vice president of the European Parliament. So the Meloni issue is quite interesting as it reveals a new form of whatever European integration of a country, of a state, Italy, that once was a problem spot for European issues. The Macron issue has to unveil. It will be very interesting. My reading at this, we may have another talk about that when it all unfolds. My talk is he wants to present Marine Le Pen with responsibility. And there is just one example from European politics that was done in 2000 when the then Austrian Chancellor Schüssel appointed the ultra-fascist Haider Party, to a government function. 2 years later, they dissolved. This dissolving a right party is one thing, but it does not change people's mindsets. You just dissolve a party. The mindset is there, and now we see a disastrous renewal and renaissance of ultra-right, racist, right-wing ideas in Austria.
Well, let's just end then with the right, because it allows us to get easily from Meloni and Le Pen back to Germany and the forthcoming elections and the east of Germany up in the fall. So I think it's safe to say that the one issue that is at the top of Meloni's agenda, the one issue that is at the top of Le Pen's agenda, the one issue that is top of Geert Wilders' agenda in the Netherlands, the one issue that's at the top of the agenda for the AfD in Germany, the one issue that's at the top of the agenda for the Swedish Democrats, and they're all running on this issue, is immigration. So what we're going to see And again, I one of our previous podcasts several years ago, I said at the end of that, the next major elections will be on immigration again, despite whatever happens in Ukraine or Russia. And that is indeed the case. Every several years, much like in the U.S., the issue of immigration comes to the fore, then it recedes, then it comes to the fore, and then it recedes. And right now, it's very much to the fore. So immigration is the number one issue in Europe, I would say, along with Ukraine. But immigration seems to be even more in the front of people's minds. And immigration, I think, will be the predominant issue when the states of Eastern Germany have their elections in the fall. So why don't you just end with a comment on what's going to happen now and through Germany, and then we need to close.
I end with the immigration issue. We call it, let's put it, it's illegal immigration. Never before in history, and this refers to America as well as Europe, has illegal immigration been instrumentalized by hostile foreign powers as we see it today. You see this on your southern border. It's no longer poor Mexicans wishing for an American dream and a Cadillac in their garage. It's people from all over the world, maybe coming steered by Maduro and whoever commands Maduro. And we see the very same. We see that the misery in many parts of the world is brutally exploited by dictators and by no one more so than by Putin. And he directs migration movements as a means to destabilize European and probably also American politics. And this is completely new. That has never, there has been migration that has been seeking refuge, but this quality we have now is new, and you have to do something against it. And this is not just, you can't leave it to the extreme right. The thing is, the extreme right is there because it's for quite a long time been neglected. The issue has to be tangled because there is no bound and no limit to it. The welfare state and the economy will collapse if you allow it in an uncontrolled fashion.
Right. Immigration is such a complicated issue. We can talk about immigration policy until we're blue in the face. The point, however we choose to describe it, legal or illegal immigration in all of its forms is the number one issue in Europe, I would suggest. And clearly it needs to be dealt with in some way, and it can be dealt with by a resurgent far right or potentially the center of Europe. And maybe if we can just end with one final positive takeaway, despite the increases in the far right in Europe, it seems that indeed the center has held. And at least in Brussels and Strasbourg, I think what we'll continue to have are fairly competent bureaucrats doing their bureaucratic thing and hopefully solving Europe's problems.
No doubt about it. And what I would like to see is the rise of voter turnout, to me, is a positive signal that the European issue in its complete importance for solutions to problems affecting more than one member state has finally sunken into the minds of people. Don't forget, most people know nothing about how Europe works every day. And it's very difficult to explain. So I think I had a positive understanding. The far right, especially the far right in Germany, which I detest, could have done much better had they not sunken into their scandals. And maybe, and this is a hope for the next program, maybe we should see something out of the ordinary occur in France. I would very much wish so, because dramatically speaking, France and Germany's cooperation is a cornerstone and will be a cornerstone of a productive and a successful European Union.
All right. And so I guess we'll see what happens at the end of the month and the first week of July in the French elections, and then what's happening in East Germany in the fall. So thank you, Dr. Günter Donner.
The pleasure was all mine.
And we'll look forward to more political discussions in the future. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Thank you. just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the AmericaCentrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.